Chapter 6. "A female savage," I said, "belonging to some backward race like those to be found in New Guinea or in our African forests." I had spoken without the slightest conviction. Arthur Levin asked me, almost violently, if I had ever noted such grace and finesse of feature among primitive tribes. He was right 100 times over, and I could think of nothing else to say. Professor Antel, who appeared to be lost in thought, had nevertheless listened to our conversation. "The most primitive people on our planet have a language," he finally said. "This girl cannot talk." We searched round the neighbourhood of the stream, but without finding the slightest trace of the stranger. So we then made our way back to our launch in the clearing. The professor thought of taking off once more to attempt a landing at some more civilized spot, but Levin suggested stopping where we were for at least 24 hours to try to establish another contact with the inhabitants of this jungle. I supported him in this suggestion, which eventually prevailed. We dared not admit to one another that the hope of seeing the stranger again held us attached to this vicinity. The afternoon went by without incident. But towards evening, after admiring the fantastic setting of Betelgeuse, which flooded the horizon beyond all human imagination, we had the impression of some change in our surroundings. The jungle was gradually animated with furtive rustlings and snappings, and we felt we were being spied upon through the foliage by invisible eyes. We spent an uneventful night, however, barricaded in our launch, keeping watch in turns. At dawn we experienced the same sensation, and I fancied I heard some shrill little cries like those Nova had uttered the day before. But none of the creatures with which our feverish imagination peopled the forest revealed itself. So we decided to return to the waterfall, and all the way there we were obsessed by the unnerving impression of being followed and watched by creatures that dared not show themselves. Yet Nova, the day before, had been willing to approach us.
"Perhaps it's our clothes that frighten them," Arthur Levin said all of a sudden. This seemed the most likely explanation. I distinctly remembered that when Nova fled after strangling our monkey, she had found herself in front of our pile of clothes. She had then sprung aside briskly to avoid them, like a shy horse.
"We'll soon see." And diving into the lake after undressing, we started playing again as on the day before, ostensibly oblivious of all that surrounded us. The same trick resulted in the same success. After a few minutes, we noticed the girl on the rocky ledge, without having heard her approach. She was not alone. There was a man standing beside her. A man built like us, resembling men on Earth, a middle-aged man, likewise completely naked, whose features were so similar to those of our goddess that I assumed he was her father. He was watching us as she was, in an attitude of bewilderment and concern. And there were many others. We noticed them little by little, while we forced ourselves to maintain our feigned indifference. They crept furtively out of the forest, and gradually formed an unbroken circle round the lake. They were all sturdy, handsome specimens of humanity, men and women with golden skins, looking restless now, evidently prey to a great excitement, and uttering an occasional sharp cry. We were hemmed in and felt somewhat anxious, remembering the incident with the chimpanzee. But their attitude was not menacing. They, too, simply appeared to be interested in our evolutions. That was it. Presently Nova, whom I already regarded as an old acquaintance, slipped into the water, and the others followed suit one by one with varying degrees of hesitation. They all drew closer, and we began to chase one another in the manner of seals as we had done on the previous day, with the difference that we were now surrounded by a score or more of these strange creatures, splashing about and playing, all with solemn expressions, contrasting oddly with these childish frolics.
After a quarter of an hour of this, I was beginning to feel tired. Was it just to behave like schoolchildren that we had come all the way to the universe of Betelgeuse? I felt almost ashamed of myself, and was vexed to see that the learned Antel appeared to be taking great pleasure in this game. But what else could we do? It is hard to imagine the difficulty of establishing contact with creatures who are ignorant of the spoken word or of laughter. Yet I did my best. I went through a few motions which had the pretension of being significant. I clasped my hands in as friendly an attitude as possible, bowing at the same time, rather in the manner of the Chinese. I waved kisses at them. None of these manifestations awoke the least echo. Not a glimmer of comprehension appeared in their eyes. Whenever, during the voyage, we had discussed our eventual encounter with living beings, we saw in our mind's eye monstrous, misshapen creatures of a physical aspect very different from ours. But we always implicitly imagined the presence in them of a mind. On the planet Soror, reality appeared to be quite the contrary. We had to do with inhabitants resembling us in every way from the physical point of view, but who appeared to be completely devoid of the power of reason. This indeed was the meaning of the expression which I had found so disturbing in Nova, and which I now saw in all the others. A lack of conscious reflection. The absence of intelligence. They were interested only in playing. And even then, the game had to be pretty stupid. Having had the idea of introducing into it a semblance of coherence while remaining within their reach, we all three linked hands, and with the water up to our waist, shuffled round in a circle, raising and lowering our hands together, as small children might have done. This seemed not to move them in the slightest. Most of them drew away from us. Others started gazing at us with such an obvious absence of comprehension that we were ourselves dumbfounded. And it was the intensity of our dismay which gave rise to the tragedy. We were so discountenanced to find ourselves, three grown men of whom one was a world celebrity, holding one another by the hand in the process of executing a childish dance under the mocking eye of Betelgeuse, that we were unable to keep a straight face. We had undergone such constraint for the last quarter of an hour that some relief was needed. We were shaken by a burst of wild laughter, which doubled us up for several seconds without our being able to master it. Then this explosion of hilarity at last awakened an echo in these men, but certainly not what we had been hoping. A sort of tempest ruffled the lake. They started rushing off in all directions, in a state of fright which would have struck us as laughable in other circumstances. After a few moments, we found ourselves alone in the water. They ended up by collecting together on the bank, on the edge of the pool, in a trembling mob, uttering their furious little cries and stretching their arms out towards us in rage. Their gesture was so menacing that we took fright. Levin and I made for our weapons, but the wise Antel enjoined us in a whisper not to make use of them, and even not to brandish them so long as they did not approach us. We hastily dressed without taking our eyes off them. But scarcely had we donned our trousers and shirts than their agitation grew into a frenzy. It appeared that the sight of men wearing clothes was unbearable to them. Some of them took to their heels, others advanced towards us, their arms outstretched, their hands clawing the air. I picked up my carbine. Paradoxically, for such obtuse people, they appeared to grasp the meaning of this gesture, turned tail, and disappeared into the trees. We made haste to regain the launch. On our way back, I had the impression that they were still there, albeit invisible, and were following our withdrawal in silence.